Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. Again, you can pick up the book on Amazon. Why do I say again? I say it a lot sometimes. It's just the first time. And I'm already saying again. But anyway, you can get the Cognitive Rampage, A Dose of Authentic Revelation, which is actually the hidden application of transrational structure behavior theory. But it's hard to sell that book, so no. The Cognitive Rampage is the application of that. You can use that book to optimize your life, improve your life, increase your self-awareness, really get to understand and reveal your authentic self, battle any addiction, reveal passions, true friends, direction. It's, if you like to be challenged, it'll definitely give you that at a minimum. But also, Dollar Mental Health Club. It's mental training. Me and you on the phone, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, or 60 minutes. It's not therapy. It's mental training. I'll break the ice. Don't worry. You don't have to call and get all weird. Don't worry about it. It's not like that. It's about practicing in the present. It's about me teaching and giving you skills that you can use and apply, psychological skills, mental health skills, tools, tips, things that they teach the counselors. I give you those tools, teach you through it, but apply it on a personal level too. It's about customizing that approach. That's what the book does as well. It's not me in the book telling you this is the path and this is the way. Excuse me. It's giving you the tools and showing you the research, giving you the science, and then you answer questions. You walk through that analysis. And it becomes your path, right? It's customized, right? But Dollar Mental Health Club is how you and I can work together quickly, 15 minutes in the car, driving, no waiting rooms, right? No crazy insurance mazes that you have to go through. Just pure on mental training. Go to dollarmentalhealthclub.com. It's simple. Click, pick the time, pick the date, pay the thing. We call you. We get to it. My Coatee. I've been drinking them a lot lately, at least one or two a day I'm averaging about right now. But My Coatee, the nectar of the gods, probiotic, artisanal blend. I'm still not saying that one, Alfred. I'm not saying that middle word. You can post it on Facebook or something, okay? But no, My Coatee, it is very clean water. That's mostly what's important. Is knowing the water's clean. It has this UV process, all this technical stuff, right? It's not my lane. But they make it clean. It's like 2.6 pH. It's beautiful, right? Then they add the probiotics into it that come from the mushrooms, etc. It's good. It's beautiful. It's good for you. It's what I drink. It's what you should drink. MyCoTEA. DrinkMyCoTEA.com. That's where you go. Alfred, you're the man. Appreciate the love. Appreciate the taste. Thanks for keep doing it, because they got some special stuff coming out too. They're going to start specializing, customizing. I'm all about customizing, right? So My Coatee, they're going to be doing that soon. But anyway, go to drinkmycoatee.com. It's good. On the podcast is a legend. A legend. He can't be a legend, I guess, right? The man's still walking the earth. He's legendary. That's better. You want to talk about writing books on a subject and addiction? Check. Dr. Stanton Peale has done that and then some. He has challenged the status quo from day one. One of the first that I know to speak out against certain generalized applications that were used for in the treatment of addiction, etc. We cover all that and then some, where he does. And, I mean, this man studied with the greats. I mean, he sat with one of my favorite mentors, or virtual mentors, if you will, the late Dr. Albert Ellis, the founder of rationally emotive therapy, or even rationally emotive behavior therapy, but if you will, the grandfather of the cognitive approaches, right? The present approaches. But anyway, he got to spend time with Ellis. We talked about it, but he covers so much. And listen with an open mind. If you're a fan of the 12 steps, if you're working the steps, whatever, listen with an open mind. When you feel anything beating against you of like, no, if you start making subjective statements about what is, basically using periods or exclamation points, understand that truth is perception, right? So it's to the perceiver and to what you experienced. So let this podcast for a moment, if anything, allow what you've experienced to be challenged from a different reality and a different perception. As you want people to accept your perceptions, then you need to listen to other people's perceptions, knowing the truth is what we make it. So until science kicks in and other ways around perception, right, to prove of what's provable, what's not, etc. But we get deep. It may get personal to you, but again, listen with some humility. Remember, humility is a practice. Practice it as you're listening to this. Keep an open mind. It was an honor and a pleasure to speak with Dr. Stanton Peel.
As you all saw, my cognitive rampage yesterday, I couldn't help it. I went off. But the man that we're going to be talking to today is a legend, an author. When I read his stuff early years ago in my time in addiction, it kind of sparked the cognitive rampage, if you will. It began that transition over between this clinical practice of treatment to addiction. It broke me out in my way reading this work. So for those of you that listen to the cognitive rampage that kind of understand how I and we look at addiction, this gentleman, this master, this author, this psychotherapist, lawyer, I don't know, everything. This guy began this fight almost 40 years ago. So the fight against the common, let's just call it the medical approach for treatment of addiction, he's been fighting that long before the cognitive rampage even came around. So for me, having a general at arms who basically led this fight on the show, is an honor to me. And thank you, Glenn Marshall, for connecting us as well, from the Addictive Podcast. But this is going to be fun for me. Dr. Stanton Peel, thank you for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure entirely. It's great to be reaching all the way down to Orlando, Florida from Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Oh man, I could hear the Brooklyn in you the minute we finally got on air. So apologize to, I'm sorry for those people that were tuning in. You know, technology can really be a bitch sometimes.
It's a bummer sometimes, but like you said, we hung in there. You know, when you addiction is a life issue and recovery is a life solution, and you don't go somewhere and somebody gives you a pill or hits you over the head and you're good. You kind of rearrange the basics in your life, and that's what's good. And that's what you and I did in terms of our broadcast.
Yeah, that's exactly what we were doing. You know, I wanted to, I talk a lot about, you know, Freud gets a lot of shit, but back in the day when Freud came out and basically said, look, it's not because of chemicals or demons. It's because you want to fuck your mom. You know, that was fucking wow. You know what I mean? To have the cojones to do something like that, to have the gumph, the gall to come out against with theories like that. And then Albert Ellis, to me, kind of did the same thing when he came out with, I'm a huge Ellis fan, when he came out with the rational emotive behavior approach, you know, basically saying, no, it's not about feelings. It's about what you think. You know, those are revolutionary ideas. Lazarus, too, adding to that. But for me, in addiction, your name is on that level, to where it goes, no, it's not about steps. It's not about, you know, all of this disease stuff. It's you, for me, you kind of started that.
Buddy, I like the way your mind is trending. Freud, Albert Ellis, Stanton Peel. I like the ring of that. I agree with you. Freud came up. I mean, he's a little out of favor now because we don't, and to me, just jumping way ahead, Freud is trauma theory. Trauma theory is Freud revisited. What's good about Freud and what's good about trauma theory is something in your life has been happening. It's not that you were born this way, and that caused you to go down the path that you've gone. Where people reject Freud now, and where I reject Freud and trauma theory, is it's not one thing that happened to you. You can't, like, put your life under a microscope and identify some specific errant happening, and that created everything thereafter. That's just as deterministic as the genetic model. Come Albert Ellis, and what's good about Albert Ellis is Albert Ellis is in the here and now. He says to you, well, what are you thinking and saying now? Because that's where we're at. You know, cut all that other crap out of it. Let's get to the present. Brilliant insight. And, you know, I've met Albert Ellis more than once, and I once spent an entire evening with him, with Ethan Adelman, the drug policy reform guy. His girlfriend at the time, her aunt lived with Albert Ellis. So we had that's a whole story in the memoir I'm writing, that night, my night with Albert Ellis. Flash forward one more time. A part of me is a social psychologist. Addiction is not entirely in your mind. It's not just a matter of, let's rearrange my thinking. That's helpful. It's important. And one of the things that's important to know is that you don't have a disease. And my good friend Steve Slate has a TEDx thing about that, that a major part of overcoming addiction is being aware and convincing yourself that you're not dealing with a lifetime disease. Where I find that a little oversimplified is you have to look at the person's entire life space. I have a program online called the Life Process Program. I mean, there's a lot going on and into your life. Who you're living with, where you're living, what kind of work you have, especially what kind of purpose you have in life. You can't do it all inside your head, or it's been done, but we're talking about the entire ball of wax that is your life when we're looking at addiction and recovery from addiction. And what I meant to communicate by the Life Process Program is you've got to boil it down to all of the essential ingredients of your life, your values, your purpose, your responsibility, your maturity, your associates and intimate relationships, your family, because all of those wire into that where you are now, your mindset and your ability, your likelihood of being addicted and your ability to overcome addiction. So I like to think I'm one step down the road from Freud, who is important for eliminating that you were born with this, to Albert Ellis, who moved us into the present tense, where you're taking a look at the entire conglomerate of your life space for understanding where your addiction's coming from and how you're going to leave it behind.
Well, I want to keep going further before we get too far. You know, for me, when I walked in, I noticed this too, that many people in the field just said, no, it's behavior. No, it's thought. No, it's this. And you were the one saying, wait, it's all of it. It's bringing the idea of all of that together. So before I kind of walk down deeper in that, I wanted to know more, when did addiction, or why that field, man? What was the little peel like, right? What was that childhood like? What did you come into? Why addiction? Did you see it? How did you walk into it, man?
Well, I give a lecture. Everything I do, I like to make people uncomfortable. I don't believe that you can change their attitudes by being in a comfort zone. So people say, one thing people notice about me is that I create discomfort often when I lecture or give a workshop, and people sort of say, well, why aren't you nice? And I feel if you're sitting there and you're too happy, then we're not really rearranging your thinking. You know, you need to really be, you know, I have to make you uncomfortable. So I'll start my lecture with a bunch of people who are often recovering. They're working at a treatment center. And I'll say, well, I want to confess a few things to you. It's going to take a few minutes, just all the confessions I have to make. I've personally never been addicted to a drug or alcohol, although everybody understands what addiction is, and we'll get into that. Everybody's had addictive relationships, and I didn't write Love and Addiction by accident. You know, let's just say I tend in that direction. All right, I didn't really have any drug. I don't have a single drug and alcohol abusing relative even. You know, I never took a single course. I have a PhD, but I never took a single course about drugs or alcohol or addiction. You know, I never worked at a treatment center. I have to confess, the jobs that many of you've had, although flash forward, I created a treatment center. I was the clinical director of a residential treatment center. So by now, everybody's really uncomfortable and itching in their pants. They're saying, who the hell's this guy? What's he know? And then I say, but I just want to say something to you. You're old Johnny come latelys. Because I've been thinking constantly, kind of more or less, about addiction since I was 5 years old. Maybe let me tell you a little bit on my journey. My parents were pretty abstemious. I grew up in a kind of lower middle class Jewish household. They're kind of famous for drinking Mogen David wine on the holidays. And it's just, you'll get diabetes before you become an alcoholic drinking that stuff. But I lived in a block in South Philadelphia, and we had a neighbor who would be dragged home in the morning drunk, having drunk, been drinking alcohol all night. And I was fascinated by that. It preoccupied me. And I would ask my mother, well, why would someone, as a Jew in South Philly, I had to keep my wits about me. Do you know what I mean? You could get jumped there. I lived in a kind of largely Catholic neighborhood. Why would a person leave themselves defenseless? I asked that question. I would ask my mother, I pepper my mother with these questions at 5 years old. And I would say, what, you know, Stanton, what's with you? You know, I don't think 5 year olds are fascinated by alcoholism. Flash forward to the age of 12. I was reading an article in the Philadelphia Bulletin, and a man had come back from rehab. His wife had moved in the interim, and he came to a apartment filled with cardboard boxes, and he immediately took one look at them and ran out and went on a drinking binge. And I said, I understand that experience, and I understand where people face a world that they feel uncomfortable or incapable of dealing with, and they seek some kind of a refuge. But in seeking that refuge, in fact, they make their actual situation worse. And the reason I know that, bless his poor dead soul, is my father Ted was, you know, people don't use the word neurotic much anymore. My father was an anxious wreck. Every word out of his mouth was anxiety ridden. He was constantly yelling and confronting things and clashing with the world around him. And I perceived from a very early age that that was dysfunctional, that his behavior was motivated by his anxieties and the world around him. And his response did nothing but worsen that situation. So I looked at that story about the guy coming out of rehab, and I immediately made that connection. And I said, if that's addiction, I know addiction. I've lived addiction. So going back to the original story, you know, what do you know about addiction? I've lived it. My father would wake up in the morning screaming. The world was too anxiety producing for him. Which flashes back to another question, which I'm writing in my memoir. Was I traumatized? You know, my parents weren't divorced. Nobody sexually abused me. Nobody hit me. I had a reasonable existence, but my life was permeated by the anxieties of I had a girlfriend who was a psychologist and said, your father's the most anxious human being I've ever met outside of a mental institution. So my father was never treated for anything. By the way, in his early 40s, my father smoked. He went to he went and got an x-ray of his chest, and they told him he had smoking spots. And my father, very anxious man, you could see why he smoked, stopped smoking and started chewing cheap Philly cigars. An early example of harm reduction. Cheap Philly cigars, man, they were odious, but you generally are not going to get lung cancer from that, you know? And my father was as addicted. Not only was he as addicted as anybody, my father was brought up with only his mother. He was as traumatized as anybody around. He was as anxious as anybody around. And yet, nonetheless, he was able to cure his own addiction kind of instantly based on, you know, hey, buddy, you're going to die. And so flash forward one bit more, and I'm in college, and I have a roommate, Mark, And Mark's a junior in college. He starts dating a girl who's a junior in high school. Mark hadn't been very successful socially. And they latched on to each other. And Mark said to me, well, if I can be with my girlfriend, let's call her Joan, why would I spend any time with anybody else? And I thought, okay, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? And he was a talented but insecure man, and his girlfriend was in a bad household. You know, she was the least favorite rebellious child there. And in our senior year, they got married. The next year, he moved to Berkeley to be a graduate student in physics. And one day he came home and his wife had left him a note. Goodbye, Mark. Because, you know, she was a junior in Philadelphia schools and she met Mark and he was great. Then she went to Berkeley and she was a good-looking 20-year-old and she had more options.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And I said to myself, I thought what they were doing was love. But really it was an addiction. They were affixed to each other to deal with some kind of I wouldn't call it a trauma. I would call it an ongoing, unsupportable situation, bad feelings about themselves, that whole conglomerate. That worked for them, and they affixed themselves to each other. And then, in her case, a very, you know, extremely natural evolution from being a junior in high school to being a good-looking freshman at Berkeley eliminated her need for that fix. And I said, God, I thought it was love, but it was an addiction. And then I started writing Love and Addiction. There was one more in this ingredient. I was in graduate school at Michigan, and it was 68. There was a big article in the New York Times about drugs. And I read it, and I came to a quote from Charles Winnick, a man who's changed my life. I met him later, and I told him that. I said, well, I'm here now because of you. And the article said this: narcotics, heroin, is really not a particularly destructive drug. You can take a lot of heroin. Who's that good-looking guy there, for Christ's sake?
Hey, Stanton, it's Mick from Atlanta.
Hey. And
welcome to the Cognitive Rampage podcast, man. That's funny.
And then so he said to me, it said in the article, the main dangers that result from heroin use are infection by the needle, malnutrition, and other diseases from your environment. Per se, heroin is not a dangerous substance. Narcotics are not dangerous. And in that one sentence, it showed me that addiction and the dangers of addiction are not from a thing, a specific substance. They're from a broader array of a person's life. And it also introduced the concept of harm reduction, obviously. I mean, our goal is to not have people be addicted to heroin, but our goal is that people shouldn't die. And of course, well, if you give them clean needles, if you allow them to have food and a good place to live, we've eliminated the dying part. And then we can work our way gradually back through their lives to their addiction. So those are, you know, South Philly, the drunken neighbor, reading about the man coming home from rehab and connecting him to my father, my roommate Mark and his girlfriend Joan, and Charles Winnick, when I'm in graduate school, reading that article in the newspaper, voila, I wrote Love and Addiction.
And so it's amazing because so many people could, you know, observe those things in their life, similar things that happen to friends they know, et cetera, and not pick up on what's really happening there, right? They would simply see it as love. They would simply see it as it's just life, right? And being observant to what was really creating the behavior of the people and writing something like that, that idea, the love and addiction, I saw that working in the clinics and hearing not working in the clinics even just throws me back almost to a better place because one, you walked in it almost not corrupted, right? Because I argue that a lot of the LMHCs, all, you know, the LCSWs that go through that training, they come out biased. It comes out curbed to a belief to some sort of, this is how you do it. You know, this is the treatment, this, et cetera. And you did not take that path at all. Maybe that's the reason that, what, how many other books, 85 books followed, you know, from this subject
alone? Nobody, I like you. I'm writing my memoir, and everything you're saying is what I'm writing in my memoir. As soon as I wrote Love and Addiction, people started writing me and saying, well, that's my inner experience. How do you know about my inner experience? People who work with, I moved to California, and I was invited over to the Haight-Ashbury Clinic to their addiction counseling group. And they said, this is true. We know this is true. And they say, how do you know that? And I said, I know it because I came in without any preconceptions. I saw the core experience of addiction. And as soon as I saw that core experience, first of all, it's a unifying experience. It tells you that people who have whatever problem are not isolated groups. It's not a group of people who are addicts. And voila, they have a set of problems that nobody else has ever heard of. Well, I don't take heroin. But I also got into the inner kernel of that experience, what it felt like, which I described in Love and Addiction, and which, frankly, I knew about from my own love experiences or addictive experiences. But bless your little heart, what is it? I'm writing a chapter or two chapters, whatever, in my memoir saying, well, other people have seen the same things I've seen. Why did I focus? How was I able to focus in on the key of it? And then another important ingredient is, well, how did I have the guts and the internal fortitude to say, well, this is really what it is? Because, you know, I mean, I didn't take courses, but I knew what people thought addiction was. I knew what was out there. And I said, well, that's wrong. When Archie Brodsky and I, I met Archie Brodsky 50 years ago. When I was 17, he was 18. And then we wrote Love and Addiction together. And now I'm writing my memoir, and he's going, you know, he's editing it because, well, he's good at that because we've been working together a little while, and because he actually, Archie is the kind of mindset where he says, Stanton, you don't remember, you know, what year that was? And I said, well, not exactly. And he remembers parts of my life better than me. And one of the chapters is, how did I have the guts and the fortitude to look at what people were saying to say, well, that doesn't really make sense. That doesn't really explain this. And I have a better insight. And I don't really care if everybody disagrees with me. So one of our friends had a sister who was a psychiatric resident. And she says, we already know what addiction is. And I said, well, I believe they're wrong. And in a 40-year period since I've written Love and Addiction, people have become more and more unsure about what addiction really is. DSM, for the first time in 2013, declared that things that weren't drugs could be addictive, including gambling. And they're working their way slowly, decade by decade, back to what I saw 40 and even 50 years ago. And I have a certain intellectual fortitude. The fact.
What made you though, Doc? What, like, cause I remember when I went off on Joe Rogan, like a year, 2 years ago about the treatment center, you know, I was all in it, but 3-4 years before I just saw the bullshit that was happening going, this is crazy. But you're talking, you know, 30, 40 before anyone. I mean, that's why I made that connection between Freud, Ellis, and you, because those were game changers. You know, Freud saying it's not chemicals and evil demons. And you know, when Ellis saying, no, it's not your feelings or positive, it's what you think. And people, I mean, that's hard. And then for you at 18, 19 to go, no. You're the 1939 12 steps to think this is no. You, I mean, to do, what made you have to do that? What pushed the cognitive ramp? You know, what made you do it?
Well, my instincts were strongly in another direction. I didn't believe that way of thinking. And there's a moral impulse in what I do. I'm a human being who, my mother was kind of a commie, she didn't do anything, but she had a kind of commie set of beliefs. And I sort of learned, well, you might disagree with everybody around you, and you need to stick to it, and you need to speak out about what's right. I'm the only human being in New York, maybe, if people do something wrong in the subway, I say, hey, get your feet off the seat. You know, my kids and my ex-wife said, you're going to get murdered, you know, and actually it's never happened so far. I have a need, if I see something wrong, to just say, well, that's just not right. And even if everybody in the room turns against me, even if everybody says, well, let them put their feet on the seat, and I have the strength to forbear against that. And I owe a lot of it to my mother. She gave me the ability to have insights that said, you know, just because everybody thinks something doesn't mean it's right. In fact, that usually means it's wrong, A. And B, my mother gave me a kind of faith in myself. You know, she sort of said, don't tell anybody I said this. My mother said, well, you're a genius. And if you say something in school and they all say it's wrong, well, that's their tough luck. You know, just they should be listening to you. So I'm not an intellectually insecure person. My ex-wife would say, well, Stanton is not intellectually insecure. I mean, I don't come out with an idea and then I check it out with everybody and they all say, oh, you're crazy, blah, 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 and then I run and hide. I say, well, let's think it through. Let me give you an example. Let me rush ahead. I do this all the time. I'm in a crowd of people, hundreds, thousands, and I go, what's the toughest drug addiction to quit? Have you ever seen me do this gimmick? I'm famous for this.
Well, keep going.
And they all shout out smoking. And many of the people in the audience are in a position to compare addictions, if you know what I'm saying. You know, they're consumer shop. They're competitive shoppers. So I go, smoking's the hardest addiction to quit, huh? Has anybody in this room quit smoking? You know, and in a recovering room, you know, if there's 1,000 people, 600 people are going to raise their hands.
Yeah.
And then I go, oh, wow, you quit the toughest addiction. How many of you used any kind of therapy or support group, smoke enders, nicotine replacement therapy? And there'll be a room of 600 people who've said they quit smoking. And I've never been in a room where more than 5 people raised their hands. And so I go, oh, Jesus, God, this is a tough group. I don't know if I can deal with you. You've just all told me that a majority of people in this room have quit the toughest drug addiction of them all, and you did it basically on your own. Huh. And then if I have time, I'll say, well, what was that like? What made you quit? And of course, the reasons are, well, I had a child, or, you know, sometimes the reasons are I finally got sick of myself, you know? And then they'll say, well, you know, I struggled with it for decades. But then, and I would quit at night and then in the morning, it's like every kind of recovery story in AA, except the end part of the story is, and then one day I quit and I didn't start again. Did you ever smoke cigarettes?
Yeah. I'm laughing because the story, those people almost brag as much as a vegan will, is they'll meet you and go, yeah, I quit smoking. Just put them down one day. Walked away, never looked back, smoked 20 years, I've never seen one or one on one since. And I'm like, so how's the alcohol coming? Hey, look, it's a disease, man. It's a lifelong journey. You know, I'm recovering for life here, you know, and I see.
So what I'm doing is making the connection. Did I mention that I like to go into audiences and make people uncomfortable? And so then they're going to start arguing with me, just what you said. Well, and I said, didn't you just tell me smoking was the hardest addiction to quit? I'm only sitting here asking you questions. And they said, well, I said that, but and I said, oh, you mean you're not trustworthy? You mean I can't believe what you say, but now you want me to believe that AA worked for you after you've just told me I can't count on what you know. You won't believe this. Anybody looking at this show will think, what a fun guy. But I can sometimes arouse people's disapproval. You know what I mean? And I can float on discomfort and dislike. Yeah, every once in a while, somebody will come up to me after a lecture and they'll say, "You've got a lot of guts, don't you? You don't mind fighting with a few hundred people at once, you know?" And I say, "Whatever."
Yeah, you get used to it. I call it kicking the front door psychology.
Yeah.
You know, one of my great mentors who I love, man, he used to tell me, "Look, Adam, you don't have to kick in the front door. You can sneak in the back window and be waiting for him." And I'm like, "Man, look, you're better than me." I said, "Look, I just rampage. We come in the front door." I mean, it's still to hear that. Like, can we kind of walk through maybe the journey of the books? Because, you know, I wanted to talk about what started to come next. After the Love and Addiction book, it kind of had to walk you into the AA responders, into the NA participate. It had to kind of walk you there, right? It was, as I'm guessing, that's who began to write.
Well, right. Love and Addiction hardly mentions AA. I mean, and I was able to give lectures without confronting AA because I hardly mention AA there. I'm just talking about the inner addiction experience.
Well, I mean, it had to come after, because after you put out something on addiction, you generally, you know, when I wrote the book, The Cognitive Rampage, is kind of an alternative idea after being through it, is that, right? I got death threats from the AA cult members.
Right.
I don't know if
So the next book I wrote was How Much Is Too Much, which was a graphic novel, comic book. This is addiction experience. This is what makes an addictive experience. You become involved in an experience because it gives you a feeling of remedying your anxiety or depression. It gives you an artificial sense of control because, after all, an addiction is something you can produce on demand, sex, drugs, alcohol, and it gives you a feeling of being able to control your life. But really, it actually makes your life less controllable because it's depreciating that existence. Then in 1980, that was 1980, 1985, I wanted to backtrack to present my ideas to the academic world. So the meaning of addiction is almost an academic version of love and addiction.
Yeah, I apologize for interruption, but I totally skipped one of my favorite books when I jumped to the 12 step, just because I'm antsy to get there. But the Diseasing of America book that came out.
That was the one after the meeting where I did what you said.
Right.
That was 1989. Where I said, "Well, how did we decide it was a disease? Where does that come from in America? Why do we love diseases so much? Why, in particular, do we think alcoholism is a disease?" I related it to temperance. I related it to our American desire to have a medical solution for everybody. And, you know, I directly attacked the disease theory of everything, but alcoholism in particular. And in between, by the way, in 1983, people attacked a research program by the Sobels where they had done controlled drinking therapy, and they found that that worked better than abstinence therapy. And there was an onslaught against them. And in Psychology Today, I wrote an article called Through a Glass Darkly, and I explained the whole conflict as being, you know, steeped in American irrationality around alcohol, because we can't even pay attention to research that says, well, essentially a harm reduction approach could work better. And the onslaught was unbelievable. Let me just give a shout out to the corrupt American academic system. I had been given the keynote address at the University of Texas summer school, and they withdrew it. And I threatened to sue them, and they let me speak, but I was blacklisted after that for 5 or 10 years. People attacked me. A man named John Wallace wrote articles with my name in the title, you know, saying what you can look it up. I mean, what a asshole, what a devil this human being is. I was the object, the one object for the whole rejection of what is now we call harm reduction or alternative approaches to addiction. And so, you know, that was a heavy period. And, you know, I had sometimes the only people in the world that were supporting me were Archie, and he's a kind of quiet guy, and my former wife, bless her little heart, because, you know, it had economic I have 3 children. It had economic repercussions. It made me, I had to go out and find ways to make money because they weren't going to let me do it in addiction. And that's in my memoir, you know, How I Made a Living Stanton Peale.
Well, you're planting cognitive rampage seeds, because what you went through, that struggle, that 10 years, man, I keep referencing it because you faced it on the first level on a much huge, you know, much larger scale. I was fired from both of my clinical treatment jobs as a full-time counselor after being on Joe Rogan talking about the bullshit of treatment. Before I even got back from LA, I was fired. And then every blacklisted in every addiction treatment center in Orlando, it was a wrap. And for you to do that back then with children, with a family, to sacrifice everything you stood to gain from treating it the way they said to treat it versus what you were writing. And at the period, to say that addiction is not a disease at that time is very equivalent in my eyes to, like I said, again, Freud and these people making that statement. And I'm thank you for putting in that work, though, going 10 years doing that. But I mean, the disease model, can you walk into maybe how they shaped the disease model or why it came to be and kind of that, maybe, I don't know, blow a couple holes in it?
Well, let me give you three reasons why Americans came into the disease theory. Everybody likes to say the disease theory is a modern medical approach as opposed to temperance, but the disease theory is temperance warmed over. It's the idea that the substance is evil, it takes control of people, and they have no ability to influence that or moderate, certainly. And what AA did was, in the aftermath of Prohibition, where we rejected the temperance mentality of eliminating alcohol entirely, was to say, well, a certain group of people are alcoholics. They're born that way. They can never change that disposition. So what used to be true about temperance, that you went down that path to death, that's only true of a certain group of alcoholics. And I said, well, and that's where one place it comes from. And of course, my argument against that, which has always been part of my argument, which has become more and more apparent, is the large majority of people, that smoking story, fewer people quit smoking, even though half that audience has quit smoking addiction on their own, fewer people have quit smoking addictions than have quit heroin, cocaine, marijuana, and alcohol addictions. Because it's sort of easier to be a smoking addict, really. I mean, they're not going to arrest you. You're not going to ruin your family. I mean, you'll get kicked out of the house and your wife will say, smoke on the porch, or your husband. So it's actually harder to do those other addictions. And actually, they did research. The point at which 50% of American smokers have quit is 26 years into their habit. The point at which alcoholics quit their habit, their addiction, is 14 years in. The point at which cocaine addicts quit is 5 years in, and marijuana addicts is 6 years in. So actually smoking, even though I've demonstrated that in the audience and people are arguing with me, is actually the most long-lasting addiction and the most difficult, because that's number one, is our tradition of temperance and translating that into modern fake medical technology. Secondly, Americans like medicine and technology. People don't, you know, the whole idea of a rehab center, here's our idea. We're going to take you out of your life, bring you to a rehab center for 30 days or 2 months, voila, no more addiction. And that's only an American way of thinking. Let's nail their brains together in a new way and we'll fix them. And Americans, bless their soul, I am an American. They don't say, well, you know, we need a better community response or something. Like when a man, let's switch to another area. If a guy gets out of prison, what's going to make him not go back to prison? It's going to be that he gets a life, that he's going to be a part of the community. Hopefully, maybe he gets married. He reintegrates with his family. He gets an education. And that's the same with addiction. You get out of your life problem by re-immersing yourself and relearning and reconnecting to the universe in all of the various ways that a human being has to do. So we don't think that way in America. We don't think community response. We don't feel community. We don't feel social re-education as a way to go. We think we can fix it with medicine. You know, I just read a eulogy of somebody I cared about. It was a young woman who just went down the wrong road and died very young. It was a very sensible eulogy, but right in there, the person said, well, hopefully they'll come up with a medical cure for addiction. No, they won't. It's a sad story. It's a complex story, but it's being a human being to recognize that there are no magical solutions. There are no magical sources for addiction. There are no magical cures for addiction. And the third ingredient about why it is that we love to believe that there's some magical, amazing solution for addiction, even as our problems grow worse with addiction, is because we don't trust ourselves with drugs. I mean, Americans have that whole love-hate relationship with alcohol, but let's leave that in the back. Now we have drugs, and people say, well, drugs are bad, so they're addictive. And we make that switch. And Nora Volkow says, well, we have to lick drugs. Really, it's called the National Institute of Drug Abuse. It's not the National Institute on, well, how do you deal with drugs? Because drugs are a natural part of our lives to start with, and they're becoming a more natural part of our lives all the time. For example, we've now switched our mania and anxiety from heroin to painkillers. Okay, but you know, 50 million Americans have taken painkillers. So there's got to be an answer to the question, how do you take narcotic drugs without becoming addicted? Because basically every a large proportion of American, well, 100 million people have taken painkillers, you know, 50 million are taking them currently. There has to be an answer to the question, how do I use drugs in an integrated way, in a controlled fashion within a positive life? Because drugs aren't, they were never going away, ever, but now they're everywhere. I mean, everybody, there's painkillers, and maybe you've noticed marijuana is legal. So that we have to now say how we have to recognize that drugs are an integral part of human existence. They always have been with alcohol and other drugs. And the question is not how do we eliminate drugs. The question isn't even really how do we eliminate addiction. The question is how do we create human beings who are satisfied enough with themselves, capable enough of functioning, integrated enough in their communities, and how do we create a world that allows people to do those things? And that's our best answer to reducing addiction. And it's not, that's a tough sell.
So, I mean, so like in the, what year? So we're talking, was it the 70s when this disease model approach came out? When was it really formatted as going, okay, we know it's a medical disease and this is where we're going to focus the research. This is, and, but yet we're going to treat it with a 12-step system.
Well, it goes beyond, I mean, obviously the AA was formed in 35 and 39. They wrote the big book. And, you know, there were movies, if you've ever seen the Days of Wine and Roses, they were sort of selling it all along. And then somewhere in the 50s, and it did combine with the mental health movement, well, that's a disease. So people said, well, alcoholism disease. So that's been, we've really been selling alcoholism as a disease for 50 or 75 years. And it's just, alcohol, AA is as American as apple pie. It's a spiritual movement, and Americans have that tradition. But so that's been going on quite a while. And then we have the modern, you know, the NIDA. If you go to the White House webpage, it says, we've got a modern miracle cure. Nora Volkow has discovered it for addiction in your brain. Nora Volkow became head of the NIDA in 2003. There's been a little bad news. At the same time that the website and the drugs are, Botticelli said, we've got a modern miracle in our hands, how we can cure addiction. Unfortunately, just from 2003 to 2014, we've had epidemic rises in, there's no such thing as an overdose of heroin, but that we've had an epidemic rise in drug poisoning deaths from painkillers, heroin, and tranquilizers all at the same time, which people sort of thought was impossible because they thought people would be switching back and forth. I mean, by the way, the single greatest cause of what we call overdose deaths is mixing various drugs at the same time. If there's one little thing, having pure heroin won't kill you unless you have a dirty needle. There has not been a single death report. In North America, there's one clean injection site and one heroin maintenance program. Both are in Vancouver. There is no heroin maintenance program in the United States, but they're all over the world, in Germany, Portugal, Spain. They're doing them. As far as we're aware, no human being has ever died in a heroin maintenance or injection place. Not one. Because you can't die of heroin. You can only die of mixtures of fentanyl and heroin. You can only die of saying, I'm going to take less heroin, but I'm going to drink more so I'll get the same effect, or take barbiturates or tranquilizers to boost the effect. Okay, so we've had record levels of that. Between 2002 and 2012-13, they do a study, a 40,000-person study of alcohol use in America. Past year, substance alcohol use disorders increased between 2002 and 2013 by 50%, from 8.5% to 14%.
That's huge.
So since get the picture now. Nora Volko was revered. And Botticelli reveres her. Botticelli and Revere and Volko are American addiction treatment. They tell you it's a chronic brain disease that you can never recover from. In that same period where they've been in charge, there's a heroin tranquilizer and painkiller overdose death, and simultaneously an alcohol addiction epidemic. And yet, what we say is, it's a modern scientific miracle. Let's do more of this. We're like lemmings marching to our deaths. And here's the worst thing of all. I write for The Influence. I have a column for The Influence. And I did a table about Botticelli and Barack Obama. I mean, Barack Obama says, he didn't appoint Volko. He appointed Botticelli. Barack Obama's own life was he was stoned all the time in high school, but then, he got a purpose in life and he quit and he took cocaine. It took him longer to quit smoking. He did that in his own too. Here's the ironic thing about Botticelli. Botticelli was a controlled cocaine user. His problem was totally with alcohol. And so he smoked marijuana, but he said he used cocaine pretty regularly without a problem. The people that are saying to us that drugs cause uncontrollable behavior themselves have experienced otherwise, and convincing, here's the bottom line. The effort to convince people that drugs are an alien force to take control of your life is actually creates and is associated with and creates what we recognize now to be a drug epidemic. Because we don't actually convince people not to take drugs. All we do is pollute their experience of drug use to make them convinced that they're incapable of eliminating addiction. And so in my treatment program, when I had one, Steve Slate's treatment program, that a good part is devoted to saying, look, you don't have a disease. Let's talk about your problem. Now that we've got that off the table, of course, sometimes that's a hard sell. Now we've got that off the table, let's talk about what your problems are and let's try and dial back to where they come from and let's address them as best we can. And of course, it may be that these problems are associated with drug use, and what you do is you allow people to fully experience that. I mean, those people quit. Why did you quit smoking?
I have a 16-year-old daughter.
That's the number one answer for everything. The worst, with all due respect to present company, bums say, I'm not going to smoke if somebody makes it clear to me, if you smoke, first of all, you're polluting the air for your daughter, but you're likely to make her to smoke. You're kind of killing your daughter. Most people, no matter how big a degenerate they are, when they put that together in their head, they're going to say, I know it's hard to quit addictions, but I'm going to quit this addiction. And
belief changes, right? We are willing to face a different perception or belief about what it is we do, right?
You have to be open to that experience. It has to mean something to you. You know, if somebody comes and lectures to you and say, oh, you know, smoking's bad for you, bad, 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 drugs are bad for you, it's when you deal that back and a person says, well, this is what's important to me. My child's important to me. And then you can, if in the right way, if you get them in the right light, you say to them, how's your current behavior in line with that? And then, you know, you don't, it's not your job to tell people they're doing the wrong thing. That's really what AA does. They say, well, you got a disease. Look at all the people you've hurt. The person has to say, I really care about something or someone, and my addictive behavior is hurting the person that I say that I care about. Huh. That's a disconnect. And it's not a lecture disconnect. It's a disconnect that I know about. I feel that in my gut. And then really, it's irrelevant how the person quits the addiction at that point. They'll come up with their own best method because they know what the need is. They know where they're going. They have their motivation. And now we're just talking about technique, and they're probably going to be as good. So I often use when in individual therapy, I say to people, oh, you know, have you ever quit an addiction? They say, well, I quit smoking. And I say, well, you're a little bit of an expert on quitting addictions. You know, you've come here to have me help you quit whatever, cocaine, alcohol. But you're not only an expert on quitting addictions, you're an expert on you quitting addictions. Mm. And so let's kind of work our way from there around to what we need to change now. And the main ingredient there is you are your own agent. The idea of agency, or what people call self-empowerment, or what in psychology is called self-efficacy, that's key. You have to believe, and that's the opposite of disease theory. It's sort of getting down to a bottom line saying you, for better or worse, are responsible for your own life. You've indicated in your own life that you can be very efficacious. For example, you've quit one addiction before, and now you're facing another addiction. You have the power to do that. The reason I say that is because you may have already done it in the past. I say it because other people, I know millions have done it. Remember, we asked you to raise your hands. Cut out all this bullshit that's being imposed on you, and recognize your own power and ability to influence your life in a positive way. And don't even tell me that you failed in the past, whatever. You know, people try to quit smoking. They try to quit, do all kinds of changes. So what if it doesn't work one or two or 10 times or one or two or 5 years? You're still your own agent. And just the fact that you failed in the past, you're in a different place now. You've had more experience. You're more mature. You've lowered your anxiety level. You've gotten married. Your life's changed. You can do it. And now you've got a better basis on which to do it. Let's do it, buddy.
Yeah, I came in on once I went into a rehab and experienced the steps from one chair. And that was 15, 16 something years ago. And after about 7 days in that place of refusing to take the pills, the replacement, declare myself powerless, and all my death threats for not conforming within the population, I walked out and I never went back. And I had no plans of being a therapist. And 15 years later, I'm a clinical therapist sitting in a rehab being told to now deliver the steps. And I said, in 15 fucking years and all my studying, and you're doing the same shit you did 15 years ago that didn't work for me.
What was your monkey?
Oh, what?
Well, we don't even have to get into it.
No, yeah, I don't hide
it. How did you get out of it? What would you say got you out of that phase of your life?
Well, I went on a damn 2-year walkabout. I write about it in my book. I just left everything behind and walked. I was in the nightclub business for a while. You know, money didn't make everything okay either. You know, I sold drugs before that for a long time pretty heavily, and managed to survive through that stuff. And then just my life wasn't good. I just 2 years I walked, came back, and then became a counselor. It took me quick. You know, I just flew.
You know, they made a movie about that. What was that woman who went on a big hike and she was she started out on heroin? And what was that big movie starring?
I don't know.
Oh, it was a big movie. I wrote about it. I can't remember the name. Your viewers will probably know about it. But, it, you know, she had a heroin thing, and then she decided to take a long hike. And then she wasn't a heroin addict by the time she got to the end of the hike. She hiked on the Pacific Coast.
Yeah, I got to find that, man.
Oh, that's a famous. It was a big movie, for Christ's sake. Wake the fuck up, buddy.
I may have seen it. If it's a documentary of some kind, more than likely.
No, it was a big popular movie. I'm trying to figure out what movie. Everybody knows the movie. It wasn't the biggest hit, but it wasn't a disease movie. She even got drunk on her trip, which I liked. You know, she met some guys, but she even got laid on her trip, and. So it wasn't a normal recovery, you know, hiking.
Oh, man.
Recover. I'm looking it up here. It was a famous movie, and it had like a one-word title. I'm 70, buddy. I don't have my names on my hiking to recover movie. Oh, man.
Man, yeah, the actress, man, or if I
well, the actress is the woman who was in How to Become a. She ran for Witherspoon. Wild was the name of the movie.
Oh, Wild, Reese Witherspoon and Wild.
Yeah, she walked a You know, she started out as a heroin addict, and she walked a long way.
Ah, yeah. For me, it was nightclub business, cocaine, alcohol never really was a problem. That just kind of came, you know, with part of the business. But I was also a DJ at the time. So it would be a transfer of ecstasy and cocaine throughout 7 days. But as long as money was good, the club was open and we were making money, it didn't matter. It was just party constant. But I was just happy to have survived the drug game and dealing. And I had a lot of close calls as a young age. And
you mean you could have gotten shot in the head or something like that? Or.
Oh, at least 4 or 5 times. It got risky. I was incarcerated once. Got lucky enough to have a good lawyer. But, you know, after switching all that, I was real violent at the same time, Doc. It was, I write about it in my book briefly, but I was upset how I had to watch this. I had to be given the steps that didn't work for me. Now, when I was ready to save the world, Doc, I'm like, man, I got all this experience. I've quit all this and we've changed. Let's help some people. I got to do what? And I literally would do groups to where I think they had to keep me on because I was so entertaining in the rehab that everyone kept coming back. And then I thought, okay, it's not me being entertaining. It's the that's the system. And I started picking up on it. And then I started connecting when I looked back going, wait a minute, positive psychology would tell you that it's not your fault. You can do anything. And then the disease model then was telling these people that they had a disease, telling me I had a disease, but telling me it wasn't my fault. It's okay. Carl Rogers wanted to walk me into Happy Land all the time. And now all I got to do is change my people, places, and things, but show up at the same places with the same people talking about the same fucking things. And I saw so many contradictions. And I thought, you know, I grew up in an abusive home as a kid. And I could never once think to myself, you know, to get out of this, I should probably just declare I'm powerless. You know, I couldn't, you know how the first step, right? The powerless step as in the rehab. And then even as a practitioner, I couldn't grab a hold of this, the biggest fight of your life, declare yourself powerless. It was hard for me to, I couldn't understand. I quit all this shit. And not once did I say, oh, I'm powerless on this walk on the Native American reservation. I am powerless to the. No. You know, it spurred
if
that.
If your child had a problem, if he, you know, was weak in some area, if he stuttered, if he was bad at something, would you say to him, well, here's the problem. You just have a permanent lifetime inability to do this. It's just a weakness of your life that you'll never be able to remedy. Why don't you just learn that and deal with it? Nobody would do that. They would say, well, let's take it easy here. It's not, you know, not everybody has to dance. Not everybody has to be a good, you know, you're a good person. What you do well, and let's try and deal with this thing as best we can. You're going to get better at dealing with it. You're not going to have to, you know, bite your nails for the rest of your life. It's okay. We're not going to get down on you now, but you know, maybe when you want to go out on dates, you'll want to rethink that one. But you have the ability inside of you to be anything you want to be. And I believe that is your parent. We all know that's the way you bring about development in a person. We all know that, except when we slip into an AA frame of mind, we say, screw all that. Let's convince them that they can't change, that they have a lifetime disease. It's the opposite of what any sensible human being knows, even if they never heard of the disease, which we might as well call, let's get to the end here. We've been to about an hour. It's what you said about me. It's almost a person coming into dealing with addiction who knows nothing is better than a person who's been trained, because they've been trained into incompetence in how to view addiction. And a sensitive human being who recognizes how human beings function, how they feel, how they change, who has basic common sense and good feelings about people, that person will succeed better at dealing with other people with addictions than somebody who's gone through all of this training, including going to medical school, where they say, well, it's just a lifetime disease, they have to be maintained. To know, what's that song? To know nothing is to be the best addiction counselor. Da, 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 da. And you are. That worked, you know, for you. You strip back to what you knew as a human being.
Well, how did you see today, present? I mean, your eyes and mine have been in addiction, you know, from the change. What have you seen, or how have you seen it change from how it used to be treated to how it's treated currently?
Well, the good news and the bad news, Norivoco is the biggest thing in the world. I belong to these addiction theory groups. They say, well, nobody believes the brain disease theory. I said, everybody believes it. They teach it in high school. It's the worst thing going on. Okay. On the other hand, at the same time, we have growing the harm reduction movement. And the harm reduction movement just doesn't work with the disease movement. It sort of says, obviously, well, you know, probably smoking marijuana would be better for you than shooting up heroin. Or let's forget that. Shooting up heroin, let's at least have a clean needle. And then people say, well, they've got this addiction and you're encouraging them. And then what the data really show is, once you start taking care of yourself and connecting with some kind of a provider, you're more likely to quit the heroin because you feel better about yourself. So the whole harm reduction movement, and God bless his soul, my old friend Ethan Nadelman has made that a presence in America, is antithetical to the disease movement. Its fundamental precepts and ways of thinking are non-disease. So there's a great war going on. We're being kind of racked back and forth, but the need for a non-disease, a harm reduction approach is now more and more evident, because maybe you've noticed drugs are legal now. I mean, they've legalized marijuana. People don't realize they defelonized heroin, cocaine, and meth in California. They haven't legalized marijuana yet, but they say, you know, you can't be charged with all you can get is a kind of a summons. So they're already saying, well, look, you know, we don't want you taking heroin. We're going to give you a ticket, but we're not going to say, well, it's illegal and all, and then maybe we're going to offer you some options. You want to try and stop? Here's how you go.
Tilt your camera down some, Doc. You got to look like we're trying to blur you out in case somebody's watching.
Oh, jeez. I've been falling down on my seat here. You know what I mean?
No, I got to.
I'm old. I can barely sit up straight. Come on, buddy.
No worries. So really, I hate breaking that flow, man. You were in it. And that's separation, that where we're seeing the treatment is coming. I never really looked at it like that. That's true. When you're saying abstinence is what you preach, powerless is what you do on the inside for the social treatment. And then at the same time, you put forth harm reduction, which would then say, well, if you know they have a disease and the minute they have something of that, it should be over. But then we keep them on a little bit of something. The whole, wow.
Harm reduction is a gradualistic approach. It's basically a holistic approach. It says, well, look, you know, we're going to try and make your life better. We're going to give you a house, maybe a helping housing. If you don't, you know, what I don't. What's the name of that thing? I mean, yes. Well, starting with housing, I mean, if you want to, let's get to the grassroots. And of course, they do this in Vancouver, the Portland Hotel Service. They say, well, let's give you a place to live. Let's start there and four and three squares a day. And then let's work backwards to whatever your life problems are, whatever your drug problems are. You have to give people the fundamentals, and it's incremental. They don't start out by saying, like, you know, like, well, who are those people that bang the drums? You know, here's the deal. You have to quit taking drugs, and then we'll help you. They start out by saying, we want to help you. We're going to give you the fundamentals of a fundamental life. And then we're going to deal with the problems. The great Alan Marlatt, who died a couple of years ago, did a study of wet housing in Seattle. Wet housing is you let alcoholics drink in a safe residence. And the reason they do it is because it's very expensive to have people drinking on the street. You arrest them, they get hospitalized. So it was done for economic reasons. But the first thing, when people were able to drink as much as they wanted in a safe, clean residence, was they cut their drinking back 50%. Now, that 50% was from 18 drinks a day to 12 drinks a day. So they're still what everybody would call an alcoholic. But already they're taking care of themselves. Already they're drinking less in a way that people did. And they continued to drink less because they felt safe, secure, because they had a safe place to go, because people were saying, well, look, we're not telling you you should drink, but we're not saying you're an inhuman outcast because you drink. You deserve a life. And if we believe you deserve a life, we're encouraging you to believe that you deserve a life. We believe that, and we hope you believe that more about yourself. And that's a general mindset that allows people to become, to behave in a way that's better for themselves. And those are the fundamentals of harm reduction. The fundamentals of harm reduction don't allow people, they're antithetical to the disease concept. They don't allow people to believe and convince themselves that they are different in a debilitating way from the rest of humanity, that they cannot change on their own or with the help of others.
So what would, and say someone trying to get clean, if they tap into the whole idea of the drug being demonized and that it has some magical power on them, if this is the belief, and that mixes as well with what doctors are telling them, treatment providers are telling them that they have a disease, when that mixes together with somebody and the powerlessness, what kind of effects? I mean, how does this play out over time?
Well, it's bad for the society as a whole. If you're asking me what's a harm reduction therapeutic approach look like, because I'm a psychologist. I mean, one thing I'll start with people is to say, what do you think the worst thing you're doing to yourself in your life is right now? And, you know, a harm reduction, you know, they might be drinking and driving. They might be going out and having unsafe sex. Working. They might be using shared needles. And then I'll say, well, let's start with the worst thing you're doing and let's eliminate that. So, because I think you're going to get better unless you die. So let's eliminate you dying. It's like I think of it as a pyramid, and the very top of it is, you know, dirty needles and getting AIDS or drunk driving or, you know, violent sex. And I say, well, okay, what do we need to do to eliminate that? And then, you know, we work on that. And then what I'm showing them is we don't have to you don't have to change everything. Let's start with what's most in control. And then once they see that they can influence that, we can work our way down the pyramid. Well, maybe they're not in touch with their kids. Maybe they haven't worked in a long while. And then we've taught them that they have the ability to modify their life in a changeable way. And let's go about doing that.
You know, currently right now it's, you know, do your 30 days, you know, in detox. If you're lucky and got extra days, do another 30. Get out on their pills instead of the ones you had on the street. Go into their outpatient facility, live in their halfway houses. But at the end of the day, when 90 days is up, you go back to the environment, nothing changes. You have a Suboxone subscription or God knows what other prescription for a mental disorder that they had to give you so they could treat you. I mean, this is how I see treatment today. I mean, and I don't see much of what the core of that treatment is changing. I don't see the core of, you know, the disease model going away. Is there just too much money in this?
Well, I mean, to me, the worst thing is to the extent to which harm reduction itself could potentially be co-opted. I mean, there are drugs that make it less likely that you'll overdose. Mm-hmm. Okay, Suboxone and methadone. But those are not actually treatments for addiction. Medically assisted, medicine assisted treatment, there are ways to use drugs to make it less likely you'll die, but they're not ways to actually treat addiction. So my main worry in life right now, well, I've got a few other worries, but my main addiction worry is that harm reduction will be subsumed within, let's give everybody medications, and that's the answer to our addictive problems. And that violates to me the very sense of what harm reduction is supposed to be about. And I don't want to allow happen. And, you know, I'll just have to send Ethan Nadelman some more emails. But he sort of knows that already. And he's smart enough. He knows how the world works better than I do. I mean, he's, you know, they've legalized marijuana.
I hope they keep doing that. But what happens, though, if, I mean, I know you're at a more likely chance to die by taking the Suboxone and then crossing over, and maybe when you run out of Suboxone and you relapse, you know, maybe you don't go back to the doctor. When you cross the drug, when you mix the two drugs, that's where death, like you said.
Absolutely. Well, you know, every once in a while I get an email that makes me realize I haven't been wasting my life. I was writing back in the 80s. There's no such thing as heroin overdose. And I recently got an email where a guy said, you know, I used to give lectures against you and diatribes against you, but now we sort of are being taught in public health there's no such thing as overdose. There's drug mixing and impure drugs. And that I just want to let you know that we're kind of changing our whole paradigm for regarding how people, what you just said, you can't be fucking around mixing narcotics. That'll kill you. And so the paradigm in some advanced places, maybe more than we recognize, although not as much as we hope, is making people think, realize sensible, actual, real life data things, and then doing what makes sense in line with that. And that's just one example. So starting out by eliminating the myth of overdose helps to get to where you're at, that, you know, we're not in the business of curing addiction to one drug by mixing it with a bunch of other drugs. There are possible medications that can help you transition to where you need to be, but it's a tool and a minor tool in your larger journey.
Yeah, that's what became my issue with it, is there are those that can use it, that titrate the taper, I mean, and do it properly. But what I was seeing was a large majority of 70 to 80% of those. It just became another pill in the cycle. It was when
And you're backed up by the fact that between 2002 and 2014, we've had record death levels with painkillers, heroin, and tranquilizers. So what we're doing now can't be said to be working. We have epidemics, and all of those drug deaths really are mixture switching deaths. And so the answer isn't, oh, I know, let's give people more narcotics that they can take in their spare time to remedy drug poisoning deaths. That's not a solution for that. Your ground level feeling is reflected 100% by the data. And unfortunately, not only is it Norovolco and the NIDA who are somewhat leading us down the wrong path, but there are harm reduction advocates who are not perceiving this fundamental thing that they should be. So some of our own camp, did I ever mention I'm not as popular as I should be? You know, I'll go to a harm reduction conference and I'll say, you know, methadone has its place, but I'm never going to tell a human being, oh, you have a methadone is based on the idea that you have a metabolic disease that you'll never get over. I'd rather kill myself than tell a human being that they can't quit narcotics because they were born with some kind of a metabolic disease. So I'll say that to a bunch, way after I do that smoking thing, I'll say, you know, it's harder to quit smoking than it is to quit heroin. So I'm not going to tell anybody that they can't quit heroin. I'm not going to put people down if they rely on methadone, but I'm not going to tell them God decided that you need to be a methadone addict in place of a heroin addict. I'm never going to tell them that. And if they say, I'd like to quit all these drugs or all these narcotics, I'll say, well, let's talk about how we might do that. There are people in the harm reduction field who are giving messages that are as dangerous as the disease message. And I think they're violating our own human precepts and they're violating the fundamentals of harm reduction. And I'm not going to be a part of it. And so I can get booed out of a harm reduction meeting, even though I'm one of the fathers of harm reduction, as per that whole controlled drinking thing we were talking about. And I guess it goes back to, maybe we can end our little time together, although this is the most fun I've ever had in my life. Back to my mother, Sarah. She said, well, you know, you got to figure out what's right. And just because a lot of people dislike what you're saying, and they may dislike you, well, you've just got to keep saying it and working on it. That's all there is to it. So let's dedicate this broadcast to Sarah Fromberg, my late beloved mother. Although
Sarah Fromberg, much love for birthing this cognitive rampage seedcaster, because man, crazy people like myself, man, have been birthed from the works like you that are fighting the system, that are anti-bullshit, you know, that kick in the front door of psychology and call out bullshit, man. And thanks for being one of the very first to call it on addiction and treatment and the bullshit that they're killing people with, man.
And buddy, you look pretty good now. You look like you're pretty damn healthy. And how's your daughter doing? She doing okay?
Yeah, she's just smarter than me, man. She's killing it.
And you haven't passed along a tendency towards addiction. You've in fact generated a whole new life and outlook. So you must be doing something okay with yourself, buddy. While you're changing the world, at least you've produced, you know, a net loss of one addict. You were addicted to something and you have a daughter who's not going to be addicted to something.
Well, this speaks to, you know, what we didn't get into a lot is the genetic aspect that people argue, this genetic predisposition. And
let's do a whole other show on that. How to raise a non-addicted child. Is it genetic? Let's do that.
Oh, your other book. Yeah. Addiction Proof Your Child.
Exactly right. Buddy, I love you. This is the most fun I've ever had. I'm going to sign off.
Oh, okay, man. Well, let's schedule it again, man, and talk about that kind of stuff, dude.
That's our next topic, how to raise a non-addicted child. Love you, buddy. See ya.
Love you, man. See you later. Oh, man. I quite enjoyed that podcast. We did run for a while, but he'll be back on. I have to have him back on. We probably could have kept going for another 2 or 3 hours at a minimum. Talking about that, you know, what I was going to get into for a second there is why I'm hanging on is, my daughter is adopted, as you all know. And, she had a choice experiences, et cetera. Let's just say the genetic donor, was just about just that. Now, I didn't come around till she was about 9, but the environment was healthy before me and after the donor guy was gone, and even half the time anyway. So the environment was very good all the way up for the majority of her life, you know, from 5 years old on to 9, and it stayed good and changed. Well, that environment, if you ask me, provided by both parents there, beat the genetic influence. It beat that AKA predisposition. We can look at it. You know, I was talking to a friend the other day, talking to me, you know, I have a disease, it's in my genetics, my father, his grandfather, etc. And I say, yeah, that's probably true. You may think have this predisposition, if you will, but the environments that we put around us, the setup of the environments, the experiences we go through a lot of times can bring out this AKA predisposition, if you will. But if you modeled that and your father modeled that for you, or his father modeled that for him, and this was the behavior modeled down, well, this is how we learn. And so we begin to, well, how did, and also people like to a lot of times say that I use this to cope. You know, I used drugs to cope. And I argue that by saying, no, you didn't. You did not use the drugs to cope because the problems were still there. So you didn't cope with them. It was about using the drug to kind of more escape or have a fun, but it's not about demonizing the drugs or, you know, man, I'm going off on a tangent. He just put so much in my head to talk about, but we'll talk more about the genetic and predisposition. I'd rather the expert guy go deeper there, but I just wanted to point out the idea that the epigenetic influence, as Aubrey de Grey and Dr. Rhonda Patrick talk about a lot, that epigenetic influence can be very, if not the most powerful. So the environment we put ourselves in, and especially the internal environment that we hold up here in our heads, that internal environment, our external environments, our continual behaviors, and what we believe, what we see, can be anything, any addiction, self-sabotage, bad relationships, drugs. These are symptoms. Remember, those are symptoms. Don't fight the symptoms. Get into the root of it, the behavior of it, the reasons. Focus on the beliefs, the behavior. Take all aspects, cognitive, environmental, biological, but drop this fucking disease model, people. That's part of what this cognitive rampage started because of. I know I jumped off a lot in some rampages, interrupted the man himself, but I couldn't help it. You know, I remember being in the treatments going, what the fuck? You know, and then I talked to a legend that's been doing this, that started this 40 fucking years ago, that stood up then, makes me feel a little less crazy. And if you heard him say, you know, I'm a little not as popular as I should be, I agree with that. And Dr. Carl Hart, even when he came on, he talked on the podcast about, listen, if you're going to say the truth, you know, like Dr. Stanton Peel is, Dr. Carl Hart, et cetera, if you're going to say that, well, expect not to be popular. Don't say these things and expect to have a number 5 podcast or top 10 podcast, or expect to ever work in clinical addiction again or anything. So that's why I birthed the cognitive rampage. That's why I say fuck it. That's why I act the way that I do and put it out there, because it's not like they're going to play this shit on the radio anyway. It's not like Psychology Today might. They're pretty, they do some cool shit. But it's not like that APA or whatever is going to put this out there and go, hey, new research, new talk. Man who's been in addiction for 40 years, been claiming, and no one's seeing the idea that, you know, epidemics are rising. Not overdoses, but drug mixing. People are dying more. People are addicted more. And we've had more pills out there, and it's not helping. The contradictions in philosophy. Hey, it's a medical disease, but God made you perfect, and God must have made you with a medical disease then. But there's too many contradictions, right? I'm not touting the God idea or the power of that. It's the belief of what you can and can't beat. And if you go back to Dr. Peel's talk there, when he walks in about, you know, I would talk to Room of Addicts too, and I get that idea of going, most of the people smoke, half of them have quit, and you ask that question. That's a great correlation. So he'll be back on. Thanks for coming on the podcast and watching, listening, and learning. Thank you, Dr. Peel. If you want to find more information about him, I believe it's Stanton Peel. I had it pulled up a little while ago. Actually, it's peel.net, actually. That's pretty cool. P-E-E-L-E is the last name, but too many books. I wouldn't say too many books. A lot of books on addictions from different angles, not the same repetitive idea. Diseasing America, I really recommend starting with. I love that book. And if you're worried or you're dealing with maybe principals, teachers, doctors that are telling you your child has a mental disorder, or, you know, if you're dealing with addiction, whatever, I would recommend his child book, Addiction Proof Your Child. It's a good book, was my point. But just look into it. Question the real deal. And if you're a practitioner out there that believes, as Dr. Peel, myself, and many, many others too, that are on this front line saying this too, so shout out if I don't know your name, but, and you know that, and you see those truths, you got to speak out. You got to be willing to sacrifice everything that you gain or could potentially gain from not opposing it to truly make a statement. Got to be willing. But love you all. Hope you're taking care of you. Oh, a couple things. We have a sponsor. Look at that. My Coty. Actually, it's my friend Alfred's potion, or nectar of the gods, if you will. It's a probiotic, but it's all mushroom, all natural mushrooms. It's the pH level of the water that they worry about most. Me too. I'm pretty picky about what water I put down my my throat, but they keep a pH level. It's pretty low. It's below 2.6 or something like that. Not so much about the parts per million because it's not bacteria. It's more the fungi, etc. But check out the MyCoTe. Pick that up. This is, and it tastes good. I get sent a lot of stuff. I said that on a few other podcasts. I get sent a lot of stuff, and I only put it out there, honestly, if I like it, if it tastes good, or if I use it. And a lot of this shit tastes horrible. MyCoTe does not. It actually tastes good, man. It's like a little water with a little twist of lemon, but you taste a little lemongrass in it kind of thing. It's good, refreshing, and you know the water's clean, which is getting rare. If you saw the picture I put up about that little test they did with Smart Water, which is terrible. But MyCoTe, and secondly, Dollar Mental Health Club, that's where you can work with me actually one-on-one. It's not therapy. It's mental training. It's different. We work in the here and now. We practice in the present. We can mental train 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, 60 minutes, any one of those. But it's directly with me. What I'm not going to do is dive into childhood questions and walk through it. It's really like Dr. Peel says and believes, and I do, is that kick in your door kind of style. Let's be in the here and now. Let's make something happen, a change now. But dollarmentalhealthclub.com, set your appointment. Pick your time, pick your day. You don't have to go to a waiting room. No more odd sit there in that waiting room like, so what you seeing the therapist about, you know? No more traffic, none of that stuff. And it's only a dollar a minute. That's what I wanted to do. That's working cheap for me, but it's the only thing I could think of to somehow try to bring some kind of affordable mental health training or help to people that don't have insurance, that can't afford, you know, expensive ass copays for certain therapies. But again, this is mental training, not therapy. We work in the here and now. It's very kick in your front door. It's a different style, and we call you. So you don't have to call us. You set your appointment, doom, doom, you pay for the thing. It's a buck a minute. We call you at the time you pick. Well, I call you. And it will be me. So the voice that you hear talking, it will be me that goes, hello. Some people do get surprised. They set an appointment and I for shits and giggles, be like, welcome to the Cognitive Rampage podcast. And I'm just kidding. But it's intense, though. I don't fuck around with Dollar Mental Health Club. So if you call me and it's time to get to work, we will be training hard. MyCoTe's announced. Dollar Mental Health Club, I wanted to keep announcing. I thought I had one more thing. Oh, well, doesn't matter. That's it. I was going to talk about some people coming on the podcast. Steven Tante was coming on this morning, but he had an airport thing. He was actually boarding a plane, couldn't do it. So he is going to come on tomorrow. So at 9 a.m. tomorrow, Steven Tante, the guy I was advertising, he has that TEDx CMU speech about ADHD, but he's so much more than that. He's way deeper than that. That just put the man on the spot, in the spotlight, if you will. And let's just say he ran away with it from there. But Steven will be on then, starting at the end of the month. Cerebral Ape, my boy Stuart, will be on. Met this dude through Twitter. He's going to talk about the Aqua Ape Theory, if I said that right. Anyway, he'll educate us more. Professor Ben Hetty will be on the 25th, just that same week of him. Who else do we got? There's a couple other people coming on. Well, I can't tell you they're coming on yet. I'm working on something. We talked about him on Facebook a little bit. So anyway, I guess that's enough announcements, man. Catch me at Dollar Mental Health Club. Order some MyCoTe. Get it. Alfred, showing you some love, dude. This stuff is good. Thanks for sending it to me. I dig it. I dig it much. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you live in your cognitive rampage. Love you.